runs for the door. Then he goes to his next class, and the same thing happens. And the next class, and the next. Then Phaedrus goes home. And he wonders more and more what is going to happen next. Thanksgiving comes. His 4 hours of sleep have dwindled down to 2, and then to nothing. It is all over. He will not be going back to the study of Aristotelian rhetoric, neither will he return to the teaching of that subject. It is over. He begins to walk the streets, his mind spinning. The city closes in on him now, and in his strange perspective it becomes the antithesis of what he believes. The citadel not of quality, the citadel of form and substance. Substance in the form of steel sheets and girders, substance in the form of concrete piers and roads, in the form of brick, of asphalt, of auto parts, old radios and rails, dead carcasses of animals that once grazed the prairies. Form and substance without quality. That is the soul of this place. Blind, huge, sinister, and inhuman. Seen by the light of fire flaring upward in the night from the blast furnaces in the south, through heavy coal smoke, deeper and denser into the neon of beer and pizza and laundromat signs, and unknown and meaningless signs along meaningless straight streets going off into other straight streets forever. If it was all bricks and concrete, pure forms of substance, clearly and openly, he might survive. It is the little pathetic attempts at quality that kill. The plaster false fireplace in the apartment, shaped and waiting to contain a flame that can never exist. Or the hedge in front of the apartment building with a few square feet of grass behind it. A few square feet of grass, after Montana. If they just left out the hedge and grass, it would be all right. Now it serves only to draw attention to what has been lost. Along the streets that lead away from the apartment, he can never see anything through the concrete and brick and neon, but he knows that buried within it are grotesque, twisted souls forever trying the manners that will convince themselves they possess quality, learning strange poses of style and glamour vended by dream magazines and other mass media, and paid for by the vendors of substance. He thinks of them at night alone with their advertised glamorous shoes and stockings and underclothes off, staring through the sooty windows at the grotesque shells revealed beyond them, when the poses weaken and the truth creeps in, the only truth that exists here, crying to heaven, God, there is nothing here but dead neon and cement and brick. His time consciousness begins to go. Sometimes his thoughts race on and on at a speed seeming to approach that of light. But when he tries to make decisions relating to his surroundings, it seems to take whole minutes for a single thought to emerge. A single thought begins to grow in his mind, extracted from something he read in the dialogue Phaedrus. And what is written well, and what is written badly? Need we ask Lysias or any other poet or orator, whoever wrote or will write, either a political or other work, in meter or out of meter, poet or prose writer, to teach us this? What is good, Phaedrus, and what is not good? Need we ask anyone to tell us these things? It is what he was saying months before in the classroom in Montana, a message Plato and every dialectician since him had missed, since they all sought to define the good in its intellectual relation to things. But what he sees now is how far he has come from that. He is doing the same bad things himself. His original goal was to keep quality undefined, but in the process of battling against the dialecticians, he has made statements, and each statement has been a brick in a wall of definition he himself has been building around quality. Any attempt to develop an organized reason around an undefined quality defeats its own purpose. The organization of the reason itself defeats the quality. Everything he has been doing has been a fool's mission to begin with. On the third day, he turns a corner at an intersection of unknown streets, and his vision blanks out. When it returns, he is lying on the sidewalk, people moving around him as if he were not there. He gets up wearily and mercilessly drives his thoughts to remember the way back to the apartment. They are slowing down, slowing down. This is about the time he and Chris try to find the cellars of bunk beds for the children to sleep in. After that, he does not leave the apartment. He stares at the wall in a cross-legged position upon a quilted blanket on the floor of a bedless bedroom. All bridges have been burned. There is no road back. And now there is no way forward either. For 3 days and 3 nights, Phaedrus stares at the wall of the bedroom, his thoughts moving neither forward nor backward, staying only at the instant. His wife asks if he is sick, and he does not answer. His wife becomes angry, but Phaedrus listens without responding. He is aware of what she says, but is no longer able to feel any urgency about it. Not only are his thoughts slowing down, but his desires too. And they slow and slow, as if gaining an imponderable mass. So heavy, so tired, but no sleep comes. He feels like a giant, 1,000,000 miles tall. He feels himself extending into the universe with no limit. He begins to discard things, encumbrances that he has carried with him all his life. He tells his wife to leave with the children, to consider themselves separated. Fear of loathsomeness and shame disappear when his urine flows not deliberately but naturally on the floor of the room. Fear of pain, the pain of the martyrs, is overcome when cigarettes burn not deliberately but naturally down into his fingers until they are extinguished by blisters formed by their own heat. His wife sees his injured hands and the urine on the floor and calls for help. But before help comes, slowly, imperceptibly at first, the entire consciousness of Phaedrus begins to come apart, to dissolve and fade away. Then gradually, he no longer wonders what will happen next. He knows what will happen next, and tears flow for his family and for himself and for this world. A fragment comes and lingers from an old Christian hymn. You've got to cross that lonesome valley. It carries him forward. You've got to cross it by yourself. It seems a Western hymn that belongs out in Montana. No one else can cross it for you, it says. It seems to suggest something beyond. You've got to cross it by yourself. He crosses a lonesome valley, out of the mythos, and emerges as if from a dream, seeing that his whole consciousness, the mythos, has been a dream and no one's dream but his own, a dream he must now sustain of his own efforts. Then even he disappears, and only the dream of himself remains, with himself in it. And the quality, the arete, he has fought so hard for, has sacrificed for, has never betrayed, but in all that time has never once understood, now makes itself clear to him, and his soul is at rest. The cars are thinned out to almost none, and the road is so black it seems as though the headlight can barely fight its way through the rain to reach it. Murderous. Anything can happen, a sudden rut, an oil slick, a dead animal. But if you go too slow, they'll kill you from behind. I don't know why we still go on in this. We should have stopped long ago. I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I was looking for some sign of a motel, I guess, but not thinking about it and missing them. If we keep on like this, they'll all close. We take the next exit from the freeway, hoping it will lead somewhere, and soon are on bumpy blacktop with ruts and loose gravel. I go slowly. Street lamps overhead throw swinging arcs of sodium light through the sheets of rain. We pass from light into shadow into light into shadow again, without a single sign of welcome anywhere. A sign announces stop to our left, but does not tell which way to turn. One way looks as dark as the other. We could go endlessly through these streets and not find anything, and now not even find the freeway again. "Where are we?" Chris shouts. "I don't know." My mind has become tired and slow. I can't seem to think of the right answer, or what to do next. Now I see ahead a white glow and bright sign of a filling station far down the street. It's open. We pull up and go inside. The attendant, who looks Chris's age, watches us strangely. He doesn't know of any motel. I go to the telephone directory and find some and tell him the street addresses, and he tries to give directions, but they're poor. I call the motel he says is closest, make a reservation, and confirm the directions. In the rain and the dark streets, even with directions, we almost miss it. They have turned the light out, and when I register, nothing is said. The room is a remnant of the bleakness of the 30s, sordid, homemade by a person who didn't know carpentry. But it's dry and has a heater and beds, and that's all we want. I turn on the heater, and we sit before it, and soon the chills and shivers and damp start to leave our bones. Chris doesn't look up, just stares into the grill of the wall heater. Then, after a while, he says, "When are we going back home?" Failure. "When we get to San Francisco," I say. "Why?" "I'm so tired of just sitting and..." His voice has trailed off. "And what?" "And... I don't know. Just sitting. Like we're not really going anyplace." "Where should we go?" "I don't know. How should I know?" "I don't know either," I say. "Well, why don't you?" he says. He begins to cry. "What's the matter, Chris?" I ask. He doesn't answer. Then he puts his head in his hands and rocks back and forth. The way he does it gives me an eerie feeling. After a while, he stops and says, "When I was little, it was different."
"Oh."
"I don't know. We always did things that I wanted to do. Now I don't want to do anything." He continues to rock back and forth in that eerie way, with his face in his hands, and I don't know what to do. It's a strange, unworldly rocking motion, a fetal self-enclosure that seems to shut me out, to shut everything out. A return to somewhere that I don't know about. The bottom of the ocean. Now I know where I have seen it before. On the floor of the hospital. I don't know of anything to do. After a while, we get in our beds and I try to sleep. Then I ask Chris, "Was it better before we left Chicago?"
"Yes."
"How? What do you remember?"
"That was fun."
"Fun?"
"Yes,"
he says, and is quiet. Then he says, "Remember the time we went to look for beds?"
"That was fun?"
"Sure," he says,
and is quiet for a long time. Then he says,
"Don't you remember? You made me find all the directions home. You used to play games with us. You used to tell us all kinds of stories, and we'd go on rides to do things, and now you don't do anything."
"Yes, I do."
"No, you don't! You just sit and stare, and you don't do anything!"
I hear him crying again. Outside, the rain comes in gusts against the window, and I feel a kind of heavy pressure bear down on me. He's crying for him. It's him he misses. That's what the dream is about. In the dream. For what seems like a long time, I continue to listen to the creaking sound of the wall heater and the wind and the rain against the roof and window. Then the rain dies away and there is nothing left but a few drops of water from the trees, moving in an occasional gust of wind. Chapter 31. In the morning I'm stopped by the appearance of a green slug on the ground. It's about 6 inches long, 3/4 inch wide, and soft and almost rubbery, and covered with slime like some internal organ of an animal. All around me it's damp and wet and foggy and cold, but clear enough to see that the motel we have stopped in is on a slope with apple trees down below, and grass and small weeds under them, covered with dew or just rain that hasn't run off. I see another slug, and then another. My God, the place is crawling with them. When Chris comes out, I show one to him. It moves slowly like a snail across a leaf. He has no comment. We leave and breakfast in a town off the road called Wiat, where I see he's still in a distant mood. It's a kind of looking away mood and a not talking mood, and I leave him alone. Farther on at Leggett, we see a tourist duck pond, and we buy Cracker Jacks and throw them to the ducks, and he does this in the most unhappy way I have ever seen. Then we pass into some of the twisting coastal range road, and suddenly enter heavy fog. Then the temperature drops, and I know we're back at the ocean again. When the fog lifts, we can see the ocean from a high cliff, far out and so blue and so distant. As we ride, I become colder,
deep cold.
We stop, and I get out the jacket and put it on. I see Crisco very close to the edge of the cliff. It's at least 100 feet to the rocks below. Way too close.
Chris!
I holler. He doesn't answer. I go up, swiftly grab his shirt, and pull him back.
Don't do that, I say.
He looks at me with a strange squint. I get out extra clothes for him and hand them to him. He takes them, but he dawdles and doesn't put them on. There's no sense hurrying him. In this mood, if he wants to wait, he can. He waits and waits. 10 minutes, then 15 minutes pass. We're going to have a waiting contest. After 30 minutes of cold winds off the ocean, he asks, "Which way are we going?"
"South now, along the coast."
"Let's go back."
"Where?"
"To where it's warmer."
That would add another 100 miles.
"We have to go south now," I say.
"Why?"
"Because it would add too many miles going back."
"Let's go back."
"No, get your warm clothes on." He doesn't and just sits there on the ground. After another 15 minutes, he says,
"Let's go back."
"Chris, you're not running the cycle. I'm running it. We're going south."
"Why?"
"Because it's too far and because I've said so."
"Well, why don't we just go back?"
Anger reaches me.
"You don't really want to know, do you?"
"I want to go back. Just tell me why we can't go back."
I'm hanging on to my temper now.
"What you really want isn't to go back. What you really want is just to get me angry, Chris. If you keep it up, you'll succeed."
Flash of fear. That's what he wanted. He wants to hate me, because I'm not him. He looks down at the ground bitterly and puts his warm clothes on. Then we're back on the machine and moving down the coast again. I can imitate the father he's supposed to have, but subconsciously, at the quality level, he sees through it and knows his real father isn't here. In all this Chautauqua talk, there's been more than a touch of hypocrisy. Advice is given again and again to eliminate subject-object duality, when the biggest duality of all, the duality between me and him, remains unfaced. A mind divided against itself. But who did it? I didn't do it. And there's no way now of undoing it. I keep wondering how far it is to the bottom of that ocean out there.
What I am is a heretic who's recanted, and thereby, in everyone's eyes, saved his soul. Everyone's eyes but one, who knows deep down inside that all he has saved is his skin. I survive mainly by pleasing others. You do that to get out. To get out, you figure out what they want you to say, and then you say it with as much skill and originality as possible, and then, if they're convinced, you get out. If I hadn't turned on him, I'd still be there. But he was true to what he believed right to the end. That's the difference between us, and Chris knows it. And that's the reason why sometimes I feel he's the reality and I'm the ghost. We're on the Mendocino County coast now, and it's all wild and beautiful and open here. The hills are mostly grass, but in the lee of rocks and folds in the hills are strange flowing shrubs sculptured by the upsweep of winds from the ocean. We pass some old wooden fences, weathered gray. In the distance is an old weathered and gray farmhouse. How could anyone farm here? The fence is broken in many places. Poor. Where the road drops down from the high cliffs to the beach, we stop to rest. When I turn the engine off, Chris says,
"What are we stopping here for?"
"I'm tired."
"Well, I'm not. Let's keep going."
He's angry still. I'm angry, too.
"Just go over on the beach there and run around in circles until I'm done resting," I say.
"Let's keep going,"
he says, but I walk away and ignore it. He sits on the curb by the motorcycle.
The ocean smell of rotting organic matter is heavy here, and the cold wind doesn't allow much rest. But I find a large cluster of gray rocks where the wind is still and the heat of the sun can still be felt and enjoyed. I concentrate on the warmth of the sunlight and am grateful for what little there is.
We ride again, and what comes to me now is the realization that he's another Phaedrus, thinking the way he used to and acting the same way he used to, looking for trouble, being driven by forces he's only dimly aware of and doesn't understand. The questions, the same questions, he's got to know everything. And if he doesn't get the answer, he just drives and drives until he gets one. And that leads to another question, and he drives and drives for the answer to that, endlessly pursuing questions, never seeing, never understanding that the questions will never end. Something is missing, and he knows it, and will kill himself trying to find it. We round a sharp turn up an overhanging cliff. The ocean stretches forever, cold and blue out there, and produces a strange sense of despair. Coastal people never really know what the ocean symbolizes to landlocked inland people. What a great distant dream it is, present but unseen in the deepest levels of subconsciousness. And when they arrive at the ocean, and the conscious images are compared with the subconscious dream, there is a sense of defeat at having come so far to be so stopped by a mystery that can never be fathomed. The source of it all. A long time later, we come to a town where a luminous haze, which has seemed so natural over the ocean, is now seen in the streets of the town, giving them a certain aura, a hazy, sunny radiance that makes everything look nostalgic, as if remembered from years before. We stop in a crowded restaurant and find the last remaining empty table by a window overlooking the radiant street. Chris looks down and doesn't talk. Maybe in some way he senses that we haven't much farther to go.
I'm not hungry, he says.
You don't mind waiting while I eat?
Let's keep going. I'm not hungry.
Well, I am.
Well, I'm not. My stomach hurts.
The old symptom. I eat my lunch amid the conversation and clink of plates and spoons from the other tables, and out the window watch a bicycle and rider go by. I feel somehow we have arrived at the end of the world. I look up and see Chris is crying. Now what, I say.
My stomach. It's hurting.
Is that all?
No. I just hate everything. I'm sorry I came. I hate this trip. I thought this was going to be fun, and it isn't any fun. I'm sorry I came.
He is a truth-teller, like Phaedrus. And like Phaedrus, he looks at me now with more and more hatred. The time has come. I've been thinking, Chris, of putting you on the bus here with a ticket for home. His face has no expression on it, then surprise mixed with dismay. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig. Concluded. Cassette 11, Side 1. His face had no expression on it, then surprise mixed with dismay. I add, I'll go on myself with the motorcycle and see you in a week or two. There's no sense forcing you to continue on a vacation you hate. Now it's my turn to be surprised. His expression isn't relieved at all. The dismay gets worse, and he looks down and says nothing. He seems caught off balance now and frightened. He looks up.
Where would I stay?
Well, you can't stay at our house now because other people are there. You can stay with Grandma and Grandpa.
I don't want to stay with them.
You can stay with your aunt.
She doesn't like me. I don't like her.
You can stay with your other grandma and grandpa.
I don't want to stay there either.
I name some others, but he shakes his head. Well, who then?
I don't know.
Chris, I think you can see for yourself what the problem is. You don't want to be on this trip. You hate it. Yet you don't want to stay with anyone or go anywhere else. All these people I've mentioned, you either don't like or they don't like you. He's silent now, but tears now form. A woman at another table is looking at me angrily. She opens her mouth as if about to say something. I turn a heavy gaze on her for a long time until she closes her mouth and goes back to eating. Now Chris is crying hard, and others look over from the other tables. Let's go for a walk, I say, and get up without waiting for the check. At the cash register, the waitress says, I'm sorry the boy isn't feeling good. I nod, pay, and we're outside. I look for a bench somewhere in the luminous haze, but there is none. Instead, we climb on the cycle and go slowly south, looking for a restful place to pull off. The road leads out to the ocean again, where it climbs to a high point that apparently juts out into the ocean, but now is surrounded by banks of fog. For a moment I see a distant break in the fog where some people rest in the sand, but soon the fog rolls in and the people are obscured. I look at Chris and see a puzzled, empty look in his eyes, but as soon as I ask him to sit down, some of the anger and hatred of this morning reappear.
"Why?"
he asks. "I think it's time we should talk."
"We'll talk," he says.
All the old belligerence is back. It's the kind father image he can't stand. He knows the niceness is false. "What about the future?" I say. Stupid thing to ask.
"What about it?"
he says. "I was going to ask what you plan to do about the future."
"I'm going to let it be."
Contempt shows now. The fog opens for a moment, revealing the cliff we are on, then closes again, and a sense of inevitability about what is happening comes over me. I'm being pushed towards something, and the objects in the corner of the eye and the objects in the center of the vision are all of equal intensity now, all together in one. And I say, "Chris, I think it's time to talk about some things you don't know about." He listens a little. He senses something is coming. "Chris, you're looking at a father who was insane for a long time and is close to it again. And not just close anymore. It's here, the bottom of the ocean. I'm sending you home not because I'm angry with you, but because I'm afraid of what can happen if I continue to take responsibility for you." His face doesn't show any change of expression. He doesn't understand yet what I'm saying. "So this is going to be goodbye, Chris. And I'm not sure we'll see each other anymore." That's it. It's done. And now the rest will follow naturally. He looks at me so strangely, I think he still doesn't understand. That gaze, I've seen it somewhere. In the fog of an early morning in the marshes, there was a small duck, a teal, that gazed like this. I'd winged it, and now it couldn't fly, and I'd run up on it and seized it by the neck, and before killing it, had stopped and from some sense of the mystery of the universe, had stared into its eyes, and they gazed like this, so calm and uncomprehending, and yet so aware. Then I closed my hands around its eyes and twisted the neck until it broke, and I felt the snap between my fingers. Then I opened my hand. The eyes still gazed at me, but they stared into nothing and no longer followed my movements. "Chris, they're saying it about you." He gazes at me. "That all these troubles are in your mind." He shakes his head no. "They seem real and feel real, but they aren't." His eyes become wide. He continues to shake his head no, but comprehension overtakes him. "Things have gone from bad to worse. Trouble in school, trouble with the neighbors, trouble with your family, trouble with your friends, trouble everywhere you turn. Chris, I was the only one holding them all back, saying, 'He's all right.' And now there won't be anyone. Do you understand?" He stares, stunned. His eyes still track, but they begin to falter. "I'm not giving him strength. I never have been. I'm killing him." "It's not your fault, Chris. It never has been. Please understand that." His gaze fails in a sudden inward flash. Then his eyes close and a strange cry comes from his mouth, a wail like the sound of something far away. He turns and stumbles on the ground, then falls, doubles up and kneels and rocks back and forth, head on the ground. A faint misty wind blows in the grass around him. A seagull alights nearby. Through the fog I hear the whine of gears of a truck and am terrified by it. "You have to get up, Chris." The wail is high-pitched and inhuman, like a siren in the distance. "You must get up." He continues to rock and wail on the ground. I don't know what to do now. I have no idea what to do. It's all over. I want to run for the cliff, but fight that. I have to get him on the bus, and then the cliff will be all right. Everything is all right now, Chris. That's not my voice. I haven't forgotten you. Chris's rocking stops. How could I forget you? Chris raises his head and looks at me. A film he has always looked through at me disappears for a moment and then returns. We'll be together now. The whine of the truck is upon us. Now get up. Chris slowly sits up and stares at me. The truck arrives, stops, and the driver looks out to see if we need a ride. I shake my head no and wave him on. He nods, puts the truck in gear, and it winds off through the mist again, and there is only Chris and me. I put my jacket around him. His head is buried again between his knees, and he cries now, but it is a low-pitched human wail, not the strange cry of before. My hands are wet, and I feel that my forehead is wet, too. After a while, he wails,
"Why did you leave us?"
"When?"
"At the hospital."
"There was no choice. The police prevented it."
"Wouldn't they let you out?"
"No."
"Well then, why wouldn't you open the door?"
"What door?"
"The glass door."
A kind of slow electric shock passes through me. What glass door is he talking about?
"Don't you remember?" he says. "We were standing on one side and you were on the other side and Mom was crying."
I've never told him about that dream. How could he know about that? Oh no. We're in another dream. That's why my voice sounds so strange. I couldn't open that door. They told me not to open it. I had to do everything they said.
"I thought you didn't want to see us,"
Chris says. He looks down. The looks of terror in his eyes all these years. Now I see the door. It is in a hospital. This is the last time I will see them. I am Phaedrus. That is who I am, and they are going to destroy me for speaking the truth. It has all come together. Chris cries softly now. Cries and cries and cries. The wind from the ocean blows through the tall stems of grass all around us, and the fog begins to lift. Don't cry, Chris. Crying is just for children. After a long time, I give him a rag to wipe his face with. We gather up our stuff and pack it on the motorcycle. Now the fog suddenly lifts, and I see the sun on his face makes his expression open in a way I've never seen it before. He puts on his helmet, tightens the strap, then looks up.
Were you really insane?
Why should he ask that? No. Astonishment hits, but Chris's eyes sparkle.
I knew it,
he says. Then he climbs on the cycle, and we are off. Chapter 32. The Last Chapter. As we ride now through coastal manzanita and waxen-leafed shrubs, Chris's expression comes to mind. I knew it, he said. The cycle swings into each curve effortlessly, banking so that our weight is always down through the machine, no matter what its angle is with the ground. The way is full of flowers and surprise views, tight turns, one after another, so that the whole world rolls and pirouettes and rises and falls away. I knew it, he said. It comes back now as one of those little facts, tugging at the end of a line, saying it's not as small as I think it is. It's been in his mind for a long time. Years. All the problems he's given become more understandable. I knew it, he said. He must have heard something long ago, and in his childish misunderstanding, gotten it all mixed up. That's what Phaedrus always said. I always said. Years ago. And Chris must have believed it and kept it hidden inside ever since. We're related to each other in ways we never fully understand. Maybe hardly understand at all. He was always the real reason for coming out of the hospital. To have let him grow up alone would have been really wrong. In the dream, too, he was the one who was always trying to open the door. I haven't been carrying him at all. He's been carrying me.
I knew it, he said.
It keeps tugging on the line, saying my big problem may not be as big as I think it is, because the answer is right in front of me. For God's sake, relieve him of his burden. Be one person again. Rich air and strange perfumes from the flowers of the trees and shrubs enshroud us. Inland now, the chill is gone and the heat is upon us again. It soaks through my jacket and clothes and dries out the dampness inside. The gloves, which have been dark wet, have started to turn light again. It seems like I've been bone-chilled by that ocean damp for so long I've forgotten what heat is like. I begin to feel drowsy, and in a small ravine ahead, I see a big turn-off into picnic table. When we get to it, I cut the engine and stop. I'm sleepy, I tell Chris. I'm going to take a nap.
Me too, he says.
We sleep, and when we wake up, I feel very rested, more rested than for a long time. I take Chris's jacket and mine and tuck them under the elastic cables holding down the pack on the cycle. It's so hot I feel like leaving his helmet off. I remember that in this state they're not required. I fasten it around one of the cables.
Put mine there too, Chris says.
You need it for safety. You're not wearing yours. All right, I agree, and stow his too. The road continues to twist and wind through the trees. It upswings around hairpins and glides into new scenes, one after another, around and through brush, and then out into open spaces, where we can see canyons stretch away below.
Beautiful,
I holler to Chris.
You don't need to shout, he says.
Oh, I say and laugh. When the helmets are off, you can talk in a conversational voice. After all these days.
Well, it's beautiful anyway, I say.
More trees and shrubs and groves. It's getting warmer. Chris hangs onto my shoulders now, and I turn a little and see that he stands up on the foot pegs.
That's a little dangerous, I say. No, it isn't. I can tell.
He probably can.
Be careful anyway, I say. After a while, when we cut sharp into a hairpin under some overhanging trees, he says, Oh!
And then later on,
Ah!
And then,
Wow!
Some of these branches over the road are hanging so low, they're going to conk him on the head if he isn't careful.
What's the matter? I ask. It's so different.
What?
Everything. I never could see over your shoulders before.
The sunlight makes strange and beautiful designs through the tree branches on the road. It flits light and dark into my eyes. We swing into a curve and then up into the open sunlight. That's true. I never realized it. All this time, he's been staring into my back.
What do you see?
I ask.
It's all different.
We head into a grove again, and he says,
Don't you get scared?
No, you get used to it. After a while, he says,
Can I have a motorcycle when I get old enough?
If you take care of it.
What do you have to do?
Lots of things. You've been watching me.
Will you show me all of them?
Sure.
Is it hard?
Not if you have the right attitudes. It's having the right attitudes that's hard.
Oh.
After a while, I see he is sitting down again. Then he says,
Dad?
What?
Will I have the right attitudes?
I think so, I say. I don't think that will be any problem at all. And so we ride on and on, down through Ukiah and Hopland and Cloverdale, down into the wine country. The freeway miles seem so easy now. The engine, which has carried us halfway across a continent, drones on and on, in its continuing oblivion to everything but its own internal forces. We pass through Asti and Santa Rosa and Petaluma and Novato, on the freeway that grows wider and fuller now, swelling with cars and trucks and buses full of people. And soon by the road are houses and boats and the water of the bay. Trials never end, of course. Unhappiness and misfortune are bound to occur as long as people live. But there is a feeling now that was not here before, and is not just on the surface of things, but penetrates all the way through. We've won it. It's going to get better now. You can tell these sorts of things. Afterward. This book has a lot to say about ancient Greek perspectives and their meaning, but there is one perspective it misses. That is their view of time. They saw the future as something that came upon them from behind their backs, with the past receding away before their eyes. When you think about it, that's a more accurate metaphor than our present one. Who really can face the future? All you can do is project from the past, even when the past shows that such projections are often wrong. And who really can forget the past? What else is there to know? 10 years after the publication of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, the ancient Greek perspective is certainly appropriate. What sort of future is coming up from behind, I don't really know. But the past, spread out ahead, dominates everything in sight. Certainly no one could have predicted what has happened. Back then, after 121 others had turned this book down, one lone editor offered a standard $3,000 advance. He said the book forced him to decide what he was in publishing for, and added that although this was almost certainly the last payment, I shouldn't be discouraged. Money wasn't the point with a book like this. That was true. But then came publication day, astonishing reviews, bestseller status, magazine interviews, radio and TV interviews, movie offers, foreign publications, endless offers to speak, and fan mail. Week after week, month after month. The letters have been full of questions. Why? How did this happen? What is missing here? What was your motive? There's a sort of frustrated tone. They know there's more to this book than meets the eye. They want to hear all. There really hasn't been any all to tell. There was no deep, manipulative, ulterior motives. Writing it seemed to have higher quality than not writing it, that was all. But as time recedes ahead and the perspective surrounding the book grows larger, a somewhat more detailed answer becomes possible. There is a Swedish word, kulturbärare, which can be translated as culture bearer, but still doesn't mean much. It's not a concept that has much American use, although it should have. A culture-bearing book, like a mule, bears the culture on its back. No one should sit down to write one deliberately. Culture-bearing books occur almost accidentally, like a sudden change in the stock market. There are books of high quality that are an important part of the culture, but that is not the same. They are a part of it. They aren't carrying it anywhere. They may talk about insanity sympathetically, for example, because that's the standard cultural attitude. But they don't carry any suggestion that insanity might be something other than sickness or degeneracy. Culture-bearing books challenge cultural value assumptions, and often do so at a time when the culture is changing in favor of their challenge. The books are not necessarily of high quality. Uncle Tom's Cabin was no literary masterpiece, but it was a culture-bearing book. It came at a time when the entire culture was about to reject slavery. People seized upon it as a portrayal of their own new values, and it became an overwhelming success. The success of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance seems the result of this culture-bearing phenomenon. The involuntary shock treatment described here is against the law today. It is a violation of human liberty. The culture has changed. The book also appeared at a time of cultural upheaval on the matter of material success. Hippies were having none of it. Conservatives were baffled. Material success was the American dream. Millions of European peasants had longed for it all their lives and come to America to find it, a world in which they and their descendants would at last have enough. Now their spoiled descendants were throwing that whole dream in their faces, saying it wasn't any good. What did they want? The hippies had in mind something that they wanted and were calling it freedom. But in the final analysis, freedom is a purely negative goal. It just says something is bad. Hippies weren't really offering any alternatives other than colorful, short-term ones, and some of these were looking more and more like pure degeneracy. Degeneracy can be fun, but it's hard to keep up as a serious lifetime occupation. This book offers another, more serious alternative to material success. It's not so much an alternative as an expansion of the meaning of success to something larger than just getting a good job and staying out of trouble. And also something larger than mere freedom. It gives a positive goal to work toward that does not confine. That is the main reason for the book's success, I think. The whole culture happened to be looking for exactly what this book has to offer. That is the sense in which it is a culture bearer. The receding ancient Greek perspective of the past 10 years has a very dark side. Chris is dead. He was murdered. At about 8 p.m. on Saturday, November 17, 1979, in San Francisco, he left the Zen Center, where he was a student, to visit a friend's house a block away on Haight Street. According to witnesses, a car stopped on the street beside him, and two men, black, jumped out. One came from behind him so that Chris couldn't escape and grabbed his arms. The one in front of him emptied his pockets and found nothing and became angry. He threatened Chris with a large kitchen knife. Chris said something which the witnesses could not hear. His assailant became angrier. Chris then said something that made him even more furious. He jammed the knife into Chris's chest. Then the two jumped into their car and left. Chris leaned for a time on a parked car, trying to keep from collapsing. After a time, he staggered across the street to a lamp at the corner of Haight and Octavia. Then, with his right lung filled with blood from a severed pulmonary artery, he fell to the sidewalk and died. I go on living more from force of habit than anything else. At his funeral, we learned that he had bought a ticket that morning for England, where my second wife and I lived aboard a sailboat. Then a letter from him arrived which said, strangely, "I never thought I would ever live to see my 23rd birthday." His 23rd birthday would have been in 2 weeks. After his funeral, we packed all his things, including a second-hand motorcycle he had just bought, into an old pickup truck, and headed back across some of the western mountain and desert roads described in this book. At this time of year, the mountain forests and prairies were snow-covered and alone and beautiful. By the time we reached his grandfather's house in Minnesota, we were feeling more peaceful. There, in his grandfather's attic, his things are still stored. I tend to become taken with philosophic questions, going over them and over them and over them again in loops that go round and round and round until they either produce an answer or become so repetitively locked on they become psychiatrically dangerous. And now the question became obsessive. Where did he go? Where did Chris go? He had bought an airplane ticket that morning. He had a bank account, drawers full of clothes, and shelves full of books. He was a real, live person occupying time and space on this planet, and now suddenly, where was he gone to? Did he go up the stack at the crematorium? Was he in the little box of bones they handed back? Was he strumming a harp of gold on some overhead cloud? None of these answers made any sense. It had to be asked, what was it I was so attached to? Is it just something in the imagination? When you have done time in a mental hospital, that is never a trivial question. If he wasn't just imaginary, then where did he go? Do real things just disappear like that? If they do, then the conservation laws of physics are in trouble. But if we stay with the laws of physics, then the Chris that disappeared was unreal. Round and round and round. He used to run off like that, just to make me mad. Sooner or later, he would always appear, but where would he appear now? After all, really, where did he go? The loops eventually stopped at the realization that before it could be asked, "Where did he go?" it must be asked, "Where is the he that is gone?" There is an old cultural habit of thinking of people as primarily something material, as flesh and blood. As long as this idea held, there was no solution. The oxides of Chris's flesh and blood did, of course, go up the stack at the crematorium, but they weren't Chris. What had to be seen was that the Chris I missed so badly was not an object but a pattern, and that although the pattern included the flesh and blood of Chris, that was not all there was to it. The pattern was larger than Chris and myself, and related us in ways that neither of us understood completely, and neither of us was in complete control of. Now Chris's body, which was a part of that larger pattern, was gone. But the larger pattern remained. A huge hole had been torn out of the center of it, and that was what caused all the heartache. The pattern was looking for something to attach to and couldn't find anything. That's probably why grieving people feel such attachment to cemetery headstones and any material property or representation of the deceased. The pattern is trying to hang on to its own existence by finding some new material thing to center itself upon. Sometime later it became clearer that these thoughts were something very close to statements found in many primitive cultures. If you take that part of the pattern that is not the flesh and bones of Chris and call it the spirit of Chris or the ghost of Chris, then you can say without further translation that the spirit or ghost of Chris is looking for a new body to enter. When we hear accounts of primitives talking this way, we dismiss them as superstition because we interpret ghost or spirit as some sort of material ectoplasm, when in fact they may not mean any such thing at all. In any event, it was not many months later that my wife conceived unexpectedly. After careful discussion, we decided it was not something that should continue. I'm in my 50s. I didn't want to go through any more child-raising experiences. I'd seen enough. So we came to our conclusion and made the necessary medical appointment. Then something very strange happened. I'll never forget it. As we went over the whole decision in detail, one last time, there was a kind of dissociation, as though my wife started to recede while we sat there talking. We were looking at each other, talking normally, but it was those photographs of a rocket just after launching where you see two stages start to separate from each other in space. You think you're together, and then suddenly you see that you're not together anymore. I said, "Wait, stop, something's wrong." What it was unknown, but it was intense, and I didn't want it to continue. It was a really frightening thing, which has since become clearer. It was the larger pattern of Chris making itself known at last. We reversed our decision and now realize what a catastrophe it would have been for us if we hadn't. So I guess you could say, in this primitive way of looking at things, that Chris got his airplane ticket after all. This time, he's a little girl named Nell, and our life is back in perspective again. The hole in the pattern is being mended. 1,000 memories of Chris will always be at hand, of course, but not a destructive clinging to some material entity that can never be here again. We're in Sweden now, the home of my mother's ancestors, and I'm working on a second book, which is a sequel to this one. Nell teaches aspects of parenthood never understood before. If she cries or makes a mess or decides to be contrary, and these are relatively rare, it doesn't bother. There is always Chris's silence to compare to it. What is seen now so much more clearly is that although the names keep changing and the bodies keep changing, the larger pattern that holds us all together goes on and on. In terms of this larger pattern, the lines at the end of this book still stand. We have won it. Things are better now. You can sort of tell these things. OOOLO99IKL:I.PYKNUL:MMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMM space, 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 LLL. This last line is by Nell. She reached around the corner of the machine and banged on the keys and then watched with the same gleam Chris used to have. If the editors preserve it, it will be her first published work. Robert M. Pirsig, Gothenburg, Sweden, 1984. This concludes the reading of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig. This book was read by Michael Kramer.